This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Afani's son is one of six students missing after gunmen attacked the school on September 3rd, the first day of Cameroon's school year.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzika reporting from Cameroon. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also in Zimbabwe, five people are dead from what appears to be an outbreak of cholera in the capital, Harare. The U.S. Congress repeatedly expresses concern over the lack of political reform and respect for human rights in Egypt. And Kenya and other countries in the Horn of Africa face a growing threat from extremist Islamist organizations. We'll have these stories and more all ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the UN Human Rights Office says it is deeply concerned about the violent suppression of peaceful protest by police in the DRC ahead of the start of the electoral campaign. It says one person was recently killed and more than 140 people arrested since August. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
The UN Human Rights Office says that it is deeply concerned about the violent tactics used by Congolese police to suppress peaceful protests by civil society organizations and opposition political parties. Agency spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says it is happening despite a pledge by authorities to lift the ban on demonstrations, which has been in place since 2017.
Ahead of the crucial national elections on the 23rd of December this year, we urge the Congolese authorities to uphold the rights to freedom of expression and peaceful assembly. Any allegation of excessive use of force by the police and security forces must be investigated with a view to holding those responsible to account.
Shamdasani says one political activist has been killed in the southeast of the country, and more than 140 demonstrators have been arrested since August, many of them arbitrarily. She says people are being detained on charges such as rebellion, criminal association, vandalism, arson, and insulting a police agent. She tells VOA some people have been released from prison, and that is welcome.
However, the mere fact of their detention for expressing their views, for attempting to hold a protest, is very worrying, particularly ahead of an election. It does send a message to civil society activists and opposition political parties that dissent will not be tolerated.
Shamdasani says her office will not be monitoring the conduct of the election itself, but she says it will be monitoring the human rights environment around the election. She says human rights monitors will be observing whether people will be able to freely assemble and express themselves. She says they will see how people put in detention are being treated. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Cameroon this week, the military and armed separatists are trading blame for attacks on schools that left one principal killed, another in a coma, and six students believed kidnapped. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from the northwestern town of Bamenda.
A steady flow of relatives, friends, and well-wishers have been visiting Martina Afanwi at her home this week in Bamenda, an English-speaking town in Cameroon's northwest. They are encouraging the 40-year-old to have faith that her 11-year-old son, who was abducted on Monday from the Presbyterian School of Science and Technology, will be found safe. But Afanwi is worried because Cameroon authorities have yet to inform her of what they are doing to find her son.
I feel horrible. My heart is bleeding. It's not normal. It's horrible. The government needs to take measures. I think they have been sleeping. Nothing has been done.
Afani's son is one of six students missing after gunmen attacked the school on September 3rd, the first day of Cameroon's school year. The students are presumed kidnapped as they never returned home and no bodies were found. The school principal was discovered unconscious with machete wounds and lapsed into a coma after being rushed to the hospital. Cameroon authorities say a head teacher was murdered the same day in the northwestern village of Bamali. The commander of government troops in the northwest, General Aga Robinson, blames armed separatists who are seeking an independent English-speaking state.
About 837 weapons have been seized. The principal was shot, one of the weapons.
We have deployed our soldiers for patrols. We are securing schools.
We have also reinforced security in our borders with ammunition.
In social media posts, the separatists denied responsibility for this week's attacks and alleged kidnappings, instead blaming unspecified government-created armed groups. Let it be said loudly and clearly that our forces did not commit any act, and they only arrived at the schools after the crimes were committed, read one separatist posting. Our forces were instead there to bring order and chase occupational troops from Cameroon. Activists like Gladys Viban are calling on both sides to end the conflict.
We are not name-calling, we are not blaming, we're just saying that if we really want to build this nation and if we really want peace and prosperity for the generations ahead of us, we need to put all the guns down, sit at the table and talk about it. Nothing else will work.
Most schools in Cameroon's restive northwest and southwest have been closed since 2016 because of attacks from the separatists. In August, separatists said they would allow the schools to reopen, but without a security guarantee and at a date of their choosing. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Bamenda, Cameroon.
More than a month of Zimbabwe's election, President Emmerson Mnangagwa today announced his cabinet. For weeks, there had been considerable speculation about who he would pick to help him accomplish his goals over the next 5 years. Reporter Kutsai Zvenevashi has details from Harare.
Mnangagwa's selection of ministers has shocked many, as it somewhat breaks away from what had become a norm of recycling ministers from one term to the other. The finance ministry was given to a Professor Mthuli Ncube, who is a technocrat. Munyaradzi Dodo, the editor of Open Pali, an online publication in Zimbabwe, says the president made a great move.
You gotta hand it to them. It's a cabinet that seeks to put legitimacy in this government. Very few surprises. Also having Mthuli Ncube as a minister of finance. Zimbabweans generally did not like Patrick Chinamasa. The good professor is well respected in the financial world, and he might bring some sanity.
Patrick Chinamasa is the former finance minister whom the public did not have much confidence in. Dodo says the cabinet will certainly boost confidence in the government within and beyond Zimbabwe's borders. Unlike in strongman Robert Mugabe's cabinets, Mnangagwa has reduced his cabinet ministries to 20. Rashid Mukundu is a political analyst and commends the move.
This is a positive effect of reducing the amount of money that is spent on government administration, salaries and the like.
Mukundu notes that there is not much of gender balance in the cabinet, but the appointment of Opamu Chinguri to the Ministry of Defense is a commendable move. Charles Nyoni is an activist who has been critical of Mnangagwa's government. Mnangagwa's appointments may have influenced him to see Mnangagwa in a different light.
Given what the president had at his disposal to work with, I would say that he did his best, and actually it's a good choice because he wasn't looking at party headliners only. I am very pleased with the appointment in the Ministry of Finance, as well as the Home Affairs that has been given to Kane Matema.
The appointment of internationally accomplished Zimbabwean athlete Kestri Coventry as Minister of Youth, Sports and Culture has also impressed many. As such, the general overview is that President Mnangagwa's appointments complement his earlier election promises. Dodo says the mood will certainly change, but wonders if it will change permanently.
It's a mixed bag. Yeah, it'll give the media a lot to talk about. It'll definitely put Zimbabwe on the map and around the world in terms of the coverage. And I think it'll appease a lot of Zimbabweans in the short term. But for how long? That's the question.
The cabinet ministers are set to take their oath of service on Monday, after which they will receive their letters of appointment. Some of the ministers who had become career ministers have fallen by the wayside, and the new ministers have a mammoth task to steer Zimbabwe in a different direction. Mnangagwa says the ministries will publish the accomplishments of their first 100 days in power. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Also in Zimbabwe, health officials are on alert after five people died of what appears to be an outbreak of cholera in the capital, Harare. An outbreak of cholera in 2008 killed 5,000 people in the nation, which struggles for clean water supply and sanitation.
Liz Maupa uses a bucket to transfer water she used to bathe from her tub to her toilet. She has a four-week-old baby and a three-year-old child, but the city water supply has not been working for a month, says Maupa. So she collects water from a nearby river she boils to drink. Maupa is being extra careful after Zimbabwe's Ministry of Health on Thursday announced an outbreak of cholera in their part of the city.
I've heard about it. I heard on the news last night. So what I'm doing is I'm just trying to be hygienic so I can take care of the little ones. It's been difficult. I have a newborn baby. And I have too many water demands. At the moment, I don't have anyone to leave them with. It's not easy.
Zimbabwe's outgoing health minister, David Parirenyatwa, told reporters late Thursday about 40 people were being treated for cholera and five had already died from diarrhea and vomiting, typical symptoms of the waterborne disease. During a visit to a temporary cholera treatment camp in Harare, he warned people to wash their hands and drink only clean water.
So it's usually a problem of contaminated water. And these people were drinking water from, we suspect, certain one or two boreholes that our team here has already gone to take samples from. If they are contaminated, they will be decommissioned for now. Those that we have here are getting, most of them are getting much, much better. As usual, prevention is key. Otherwise, we will have an outbreak throughout the country.
A 2008 cholera outbreak in Zimbabwe lasted over a year and killed about 5,000 people. It was stopped only after international groups like USAID donated drugs and water treatment chemicals. The head of Zimbabwe Doctors for Human Rights, Calvin Fambirai, warns the country must improve basic sanitation to prevent further outbreaks.
The conditions that necessitate the spread of cholera and typhoid haven't changed in Zimbabwe. In fact, they are becoming worse by the day. The first problem that we face is lack of political will. Our authorities, both local and central, haven't been giving enough time, human resources, and all other resources necessary for the improvement of service delivery in the country to make sure that these archaic diseases do not continue.
Poor hygiene, water quality, and waste disposal in densely populated areas remain unsolved, notes Fambirai. Residents often go for weeks without running water or waste collection. Outgoing Health Minister Parirenyatwa said the sanitation situation would improve, a promise that many have heard before. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Coming up on 20 Minutes Past the Hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The U.S. Congress has repeatedly expressed concern over the lack of political reform and respect for human rights in Egypt. The annual report of Reporters Without Borders ranks Egypt as 161 out of 180 countries in terms of press freedom. According to the Egyptian Information Service, the Constitution provides for partisan pluralism, the peaceful rotation of power, and respect for human rights and freedoms. Syed Sadek is a professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo. He explained to VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi why political reality in Egypt seems to contradict constitutional provisions.
The government of President Sisi, the ruling elite of Egypt, is basically a security-oriented elite. They look down on the revolution. They look down on any opposition. So President Sisi is saying that you must have full control, because if you don't have full control, you will have a revolution, you will have chaos in the country. So he is less tolerant politically than President Mubarak. If you look at Egyptians, how do they follow what is happening in the world? They depend on national media, government or private, and this is now controlled. The second source is foreign media, let's say BBC, the Voice of America, Al Jazeera, and others. The third source is social media, and social media is the one responsible for the revolution. And today you have an internet law that is also trying to contain and prevent any seditious activity. And so there is a lot of control of freedom of expression, freedom of the media. Egypt is classified 161 in the freedom of the press, according to Reporters Without Frontiers. We cannot look at the Egyptian situation in isolation from what is happening regionally and internationally. Regionally, the Middle East is still autocratic, authoritarian. Europe also, that used to be a very important factor in democratization, experienced the impact of the Arab Spring in a negative way with the Syrian refugees, the rise of Daesh. America doesn't look unfavorably toward Sisi or the regimes in the Middle East. They don't care about democracy as or the situation under the democratic rules. So you cannot say that things will be improving or that there would be an optimistic image of the situation in Egypt in isolation from all this development.
There were several calls to engage political parties in a dialogue with the president, but President Sisi showed no interest. How do you explain that?
The opposition is weak, fragmented, discredited, and that's why he feels, why should he dialogue with those weak people and give them strength? Because he feels that the situation is totally controlled. He enjoys regional and international support. Those oppositionists are not that strong to challenge him. They cannot dare, for example, to call for a revolution. Even when they call for that, nobody responds. And so they lose even more and more credibility in the eyes of the public opinion.
So what's the way out of choking both political life and freedom of expression in Egypt, if any?
A struggle takes time, and you cannot get freedom overnight. This is a long-term struggle, but it has to also be taken into consideration that it is affected by many factors, including regional and international factors. If the area is moving toward more tension, strain, war in Syria or in Iran or in the Gulf, I don't think that this is the time that you will have flourishing democracy in Egypt. There is no pressure internationally on that. Also, domestically in Egypt, people are more concerned with food, rising prices, economic situation, more than freedom of expression. It's only a small elite that is interested in this issue. The rest feel that we have tried that before, and we are suffering, and we should concentrate on economic prosperity, economic flourishment, more than political liberties. And so, unfortunately, I don't see that this is going to lead you anywhere in the near future.
That was Syed Sadek, a professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi. Kenya, along with countries in the Horn of Africa, face a growing threat from extremist Islamist organizations, particularly the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. The Center for Human Rights and Policy Studies in Nairobi has created an online platform that focuses on countering violent extremism. Mutumba Rutiri is the center's director and former United Nations Special Rapporteur on contemporary forms of racism, racial discrimination, and related intolerance. He also co-authored a new book, Confronting Violent Extremism in Kenya. Reporter Ruben Chama asked him about the extent of the problem of violent extremism in Kenya.
There is no underestimating the nature of the problem. And this is a major regional security challenge. It is for sure one of Kenya's major security challenges. It is also global in nature. It is rapidly changing, which makes it a problem for the state in how it responds. Remember, those involved in violent extremism are also adapting to every move the state actually makes.
Where do you see significant progress in this whole issue, countering extremism?
I think we have seen several approaches. We've seen the military approach, which one would say that by 2018, Al-Shabaab capabilities have been significantly degraded. That's a military component. But also I can say in the last 10 years, we have seen good progress in improvement of states and security force services relationship. It has taken many, many years of attempting to learn, but I would say overall we have seen significant progress in reducing the incidence of attacks, for instance, in the cities and major urban centers. Our data shows that that has been reducing. The problem still remains, particularly in the border regions where you have incidents, but I would say in the most other urban areas we have seen a reduction in the incidents.
Any pressing setbacks or challenges?
The security services still have not reached the point where I would say that they have developed very good relations with the community the way they are supposed to be. And that's a challenge, because this is a problem that cannot be solved without the community being involved. There is, of course, a big problem with how to deal with returnees, individuals who have returned from Al-Shabaab. There's a policy gap in that. There is a challenge with who will take the lead. It is not clear where the interventions ought to be and what kind of interventions ought to be made to address the problem of those who have returned. We're also seeing increasing recruitment online, using technologies, the same technologies that promote openness and progress are also exploited by the terrorists.
And finally, Dr. Rutere, what are the key recommendations coming from your book that you have just launched?
Of course, strengthening partnerships with communities. Remember, this is a problem that affects communities, and it cannot be won without the communities themselves. So reorienting, retooling, refocusing how security services work with communities is very important. Second is to look at how do we change the communities that are affected, because beyond the individuals, there are also parents, siblings, and larger communities. They are equally affected by the problem. So we also need interventions at the community level. We need to strengthen intelligence-led security operations much more than we have at the moment. We have also made recommendations on increasing accountability in counterterrorism operations. That's always a challenge, but also equally very important in ensuring that these operations are conducted within a rule of law framework.
That was Mutuma Mutera, the director of Center for Human Rights and Policy Studies, an independent research institute on security matters in Nairobi. He was speaking with Ruben Chama for VOA in Nairobi. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and thanks for choosing the VOA.